Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Beyond Collaboration Overload, How to Work Smarter, Get Ahead, and Restore Your Well-Being by Rob Cross. Narrated by Brian Holden. Publisher's note: this audiobook has bonus material of visual elements supporting the text. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. Part 1. Breaking Freeform Collaboration Overload. The collaborative intensity of work has exploded over the past few decades, with companies transitioning to matrix-based structures, products and services becoming more complex, and team communication tools spreading everywhere. Collaboration has become the one constant of global business. Today, practically everything you do at work is a collaboration. When you attend your morning meeting, when you confer with a direct report, when you help the new person figure out the right expert to speak with about a project, when you page through your emails, when you pause to chat with a colleague, when you move from one webinar to the next while simultaneously addressing instant messages that seem to have urgent time frames, again and again, you're collaborating. Even if you go off alone to labor over a contract or a project plan, you're making changes to a piece of work that probably came to you from someone and will go to someone after you. Although you're working solo in the moment, you're still a link in a chain of collaboration that may have started as far away as the board of directors and may reach as far as the company's frontline employees and clients or customers at the other end. Collaboration is great, right? It allows companies to better serve their demanding clients. Employees can craft jobs that have greater meaning, and in general, social ties are beneficial. There's an immense body of research proving it. People with deeper and more numerous social connections have lower rates of depression, heart disease, high blood pressure, and cancer. They live longer. Research shows that even their cuts and scrapes heal more quickly. So, we should all be reveling in our rich social work environments. We should feel energized, engaged, and happy. We have never in history been in a better place to use collaborative work to thrive and do things with meaning. Yet today's corporations are not happy places. Many of them are plagued by stress, burnout, loss of engagement, unexplained declines in individual performance, attrition, mental health problems, and addiction, issues that cripple companies' never-ending quests for greater performance. We endure a volume, diversity, and velocity of collaborations that place an unprecedented tax on our time and brains. And we experience many stressful micro-interactions, caustic remarks from the new boss, cutting comments from a key account, that we rapidly forget, but these moments leave behind negative feelings that last for hours and days. We go home exhausted, but with little ability to pinpoint what is causing our burnout. Over and over, I see the collaborative stressors bleeding into people's health, families, and communities in truly disturbing ways. People no longer have time for the interactions that replenished them. Neighborhood gatherings, civic events, exercise with others, volunteering, and just being present. The impact on health and well-being makes stress more than just a concern for corporate performance. It makes this a moral issue for us all. What's going on? People love people. They need people. They thrive on social interactions, so why are they suffering? And what can be done to help individuals raise their performance and thrive? A search for insights. I didn't set out to answer these questions. When I began working with corporations, I was there to help with things companies usually hire consultants to assist with, like communication, decision-making, and innovation. But I soon realized I was in a combat zone. The stress, burnout, and exhaustion I could feel around me seemed much more urgent than any communication or decision issues. It was all deeply concerning. I heard not only about frantic attempts to keep pace with work, but also of the consequences in people's personal lives. Divorces, estrangement from children, isolation from community, health problems. I remember asking someone who seemed particularly stressed whether there was something he could do to rejuvenate himself, and he answered, "Well, I might get a chance to go to church on Sunday." That was it. Over the years, he had slowly fallen out of activities, relationships, and groups he cared about. He was down to just one thing, work. I hated seeing what was happening to people. So, the distress and frustration I was observing became the subject of my research. Over the course of 20 years, the research, with a group of colleagues, developed many layers. The team created theories and honed ideas by conducting organizational network analyses with more than 300 organizations, most of them household names. This will be discussed in A Note About Research at the end of this introduction. Throughout, I have been privileged to work in leadership programs, executive retreats, and offsites with some of the top organizations in the world. The ability to work with corporate members of the consortium that I helped found, the Connected Commons, as well as through dozens of leadership development programs that I conduct annually, has been critical in enabling me to both develop the ideas and package them in ways that have the most impact for today's busy employees. When I started this research 2 decades ago, I thought I had a pretty good sense of where the unhappiness culprits probably lay. I figured I would find the causes among such elements as always-on communication technologies, time zone-spanning corporate initiatives, poorly planned meetings, and difficult clients, of which there seems to be an endless supply. These elements had been shown to be demotivating on their own, and I hypothesized that the combination of them may have been creating a toxic sludge that was permeating corporations. But the findings of our research took me by surprise. Discovering the real problem. The main reason for much of the unhappiness among executives, managers, and employees turns out to be not some exogenous factor like technology. Instead, paradoxically, it is collaboration itself, or rather the dysfunctional forms of collaboration that most of us fall into by default. For one thing, we collaborate too much. I realize how that sounds. How can you have too much of a good thing? But what I mean by collaborating too much is that we're too eager to jump into or be dragged into active collaborations that might run better without us and that burn up our valuable time and energy. I also realize that we collaborate too much goes against the grain of most organizations. The knowledge economy is built on the implicit assumption that ideas and decisions need to be thrashed out in the presence of the crowd. The aura of importance around terms such as transparency, visibility, and crowdsourcing is an indicator of the high value placed on participation. Need an idea? Brainstorm it. Considering a new initiative? Hold a hackathon. Information needs to flow freely, we often hear. Silos need to be dismantled. In many companies, management has become an unending series of conference calls. But the reality is that we're all flooded with unproductive collaboration, and we're drowning. A drowning person is in a state of panic. A drowning person is overwhelmed and out of control, and therefore incapable of thinking through many of the things that need to be considered, such as strategies for long-term well-being and success. Moreover, a person who is drowning in unproductive collaboration can't take many of the actions that companies need their managers and employees to take. If you're like most people in today's fast-moving companies, you have a big stack of should-dos that you never get to. Your inability and your colleagues' inability to drill through should-dos is highly consequential. Companies need critical masses of people to take time to plan for the future, to help others, to analyze trends, to rethink internal processes. Dysfunctional collaboration prevents all that. The system dictates your every move and you're doomed to follow. This book will show you how to rethink beliefs, structures, and behaviors and to adopt new patterns of interacting in which you collaborate more efficiently and effectively. Are you a first-line manager? A manager of managers? A senior executive? Then this book is for you. Or maybe you are an individual contributor managing only yourself and your own performance. This book is for you too. As an individual contributor, you should learn to conquer collaboration overload so that you can embark on a satisfying career trajectory. Whatever your position, by reducing your collaboration overload, you can reclaim 18% to 24% of your time, or about one full day per week. Discovering essential collaboration. I will also show how to invest your newfound time in ways that can boost your performance and help you fulfill your potential while improving your overall well-being. The well-being factor is crucial. I want you to thrive not only in your work, but also as a physically and mentally healthy individual, family member, friend, and participant in positive social networks. Work performance means very little without well-being. Specifically, there are three relational strategies that can magnify your impact at work and make you much happier in your career and life. Those strategies are tapping broad networks early in the life of each new project while simultaneously investing in longer time horizon relationships for efficiency and innovation, which is much more counterconventional than it may sound. Becoming an energizer to stimulate a flow of great ideas and great people toward you. Engaging in targeted collaborative renewal activities to build greater physical and mental well-being. Collectively, I call these strategies, both for reducing dysfunction and building impact, essential collaboration, a term that encompasses the importance of working together as well as the need to reduce collaboration to its essentials. I've seen many firms make concerted efforts to foster networking. They knock down office walls, create walkways to route people through others' work areas, sponsor employee clubs and activities, encourage group lunches, and implement online collaboration platforms. These initiatives, however, are based on the belief that when it comes to networks, bigger is simply better. That belief is unfounded and counterproductive. Often, bigger networks just provide more ways to get overloaded with collaboration. I make this point to executives when they talk about restructurings, technology implementations, or cultural initiatives that ramp up the collaborative demands on employees. I ask them, by a show of hands, who in this room wants another email, meeting, or phone call in your lives? Of course, no hands go up. After thinking about it this way, managers are often a little sheepish about their plans for indiscriminately foisting these new demands on others. Time and again, executives acknowledge to me that, in fact, there's very little understanding in their companies, or in the corporate world as a whole, of what effective collaboration should look like. Think about that. Companies consume 85% or more of their employees' time in collaborative activities and have no idea what impact this has on corporate performance, individual productivity, or, perhaps most disturbing, employee well-being. This is amazing, given the millions invested in measuring and understanding other dimensions of work life. Companies create cost allocation and budgeting processes that are so detailed and complex they would befuddle Einstein, and they routinely insist on tracking employees' expenses to two decimal places. But measure the impact of collaboration? It rarely happens. Even though we all collaborate incessantly from the moment we open our inboxes each morning to the moment we put down our phones and roll over to go to sleep, most corporations have no one in the executive hierarchy who is knowledgeable about collaborative best practices. To be sure, there are people who can throw technology at collaborative problems, or consultants who can pontificate on the next best structure to promote agile collaboration. But these and other people are always shooting blindly, looking to simply increase the volume and speed of collaboration, without truly understanding which aspects of connectivity impact performance and well-being. As far as collaboration goes, no one is in charge. We are all swimming in this stuff, but without the right measurements, we can't see it. Surprisingly, even the most efficient collaborators can't articulate what they do differently. Their own best practices are invisible to them. In fact, I found that most people aren't consciously aware of how much they collaborate or of the extent to which collaboration contributes to or limits their success. People aren't trained to see social capital. Yet, in today's collaboratively complex work environments, nothing is more important for us all than to become more aware of how social capital works. In most organizations, therefore, the chances are slim to nil that you'll get a clear understanding of how collaboration is affecting you. Nor is there much chance that your company or colleagues will help you understand these effects. So, no one is doing it for you. It's in your hands. This is a game you need to own. The work of the more than 100 organizations in the Connected Commons Consortium that have participated in this research is uncovering practices that will help you chart your own course with significant payoffs. I will describe those practices along with hopeful signs that things are beginning to change in today's workplaces. But first, let me orient you by taking you deep into the experience of a leader I've studied, a leader whose story is inspiring, but also through no fault of his own, sad and wrenching. We'll meet him in the next chapter. Maybe you can see yourself in him. A note about the research. The findings in this book come from qualitative and quantitative studies that, to the best of my knowledge, are unparalleled in their comprehensiveness and depth. Credit for this goes to the member organizations of the Connected Commons, a group of over 100 leading organizations that have recognized the importance of this work for 2 decades. I am grateful to them for generously providing me with a researcher's most precious resources, time, funding, and access. In addition, this community of organizations created a context for these ideas to flourish through a culture of co-creation and exploration, combined with a relentless push for practical results. I will always be appreciative for and humbled by what I have learned from the members and other Connected Commons co-founders throughout the years. Drawing on data from more than 300 organizations over 2 decades, my colleagues and I have tied empirical results of network analysis to individual measures of innovation, performance, and well-being. The predictors of high performance mentioned throughout the book have come from many rigorous organizational network analyses, ONA, in groups ranging in size from several hundred to over 45,000. For an explanation of ONA, go to Chapter 7. In each case, performance metrics were separate from the network analyses and encompassed objective data, including revenue production and patent counts, and subjective measures of performance such as HR ratings. In addition, targeted streams of work informed different aspects of the research. For example, as collaboration overload began to reveal itself as a core problem over the past decade, many member organizations let us use network analysis to identify the most efficient collaborators, those who provided the greatest return in networks and took the least time. Alternatively, the work described in Chapter 8, tying relational measures to mental and physical well-being, was sponsored by a range of financial services, life sciences, high-tech, and consumer products organizations. Importantly, these companies provided access not just to network data, but to truly meaningful measures of physical health and mental well-being. The quantitative analyses and the relentless push from the consortium members to create actionable insights from this work led a subsequent series of structured interview research programs over the past decade. One set of 60-minute phone interviews, for example, included 100 women and 100 men in Connected Commons member organizations who were identified as efficient collaborators via ONA. The interviewees covered the full spectrum of knowledge workers, from individual contributors to senior managers, and clarified practices that enabled these individuals to reclaim precious time. The findings in Chapter 6 are based on separate sets of interviews. My colleagues and I asked 20 member organizations to nominate people they considered to be their most successful leaders, and we interviewed 160 of them, 80 women and 80 men. We followed this up with interviews of 100 leaders of successful project-based initiatives. These 90-minute phone-based interviews explored career-defining accomplishments of these people and the role that networks played in their success. Further, after exploring their career-defining successes, we probed their failures to clarify what had been missing from their networks at those times. These rich stories and practices informed our understanding of what distinguishes high performers. The results in Chapter 7 also employed ONA to identify individuals who created energy, purpose, and trust in networks, and interviews defined how these people did this. We have consistently seen that people who create energy or enthusiasm in networks are far more likely to become and remain high performers, as well as to move more fluidly in and out of groups. To define the behaviors of these people, my team and I would leverage the analytics from ONA to locate and interview the energizers and those energized by them. These combined perspectives led us to a rich understanding of how these people engage in collaborations. The well-being findings in Chapter 8 are, again, a testament to the Connected Commons community. Members pushed me to think not just about performance as a desired outcome in organizations, but also well-being. Again, these same organizations provided me with access to 100 very busy leaders to explore these ideas in 60-minute phone interviews. This kind of access to successful people on soft topics is difficult to get, and I am humbled by the generosity of the members to create a context that can truly help people in these hyper-connected times. 1. An amazing leader falters. When I met Scott, he was managing more than 5,000 people. He started in his organization in a technical role and for 4 or 5 years led projects with a handful of direct reports. His rise through the ranks was swift from there, culminating with being put in charge of a new product development effort that became the company's blockbuster product. If I could mention the name of the company and the product, you would immediately recognize both. The product was huge. It transformed how its customers operated, and it spawned derivative products that became big earners themselves. Over a 14 to 15 year period, because of the initial product win and the derivative solutions, Scott flew up the hierarchy. When I came in contact with him, many presumed he was in a final grooming role, and they believed he was the leading contender for the CEO spot. My team and I had come to the company to help reduce time to market for new products. And when I observed Scott, I saw what his admirers were talking about. He was clearly a strategic thinker. As soon as he had gotten into a position of real authority, he had prioritized actions aimed at increasing agility within the 3 1,800-person units he managed, all of which were part of a division that facilitated credit card payments to merchants. He broke down functional walls by merging smaller groups into larger groups. He took layers out of the hierarchy to speed decision-making. He expanded the number of people who reported directly to him from 6 to 16. This expansion in the number of his reports was a form of delayering. Some of the 16 people now reporting to him had formerly reported to some of the 6 who used to constitute his smaller core of reports. Now, he said proudly, we are less hierarchical. As a consequence, there was quite a range in responsibilities among the individuals directly below him. Some, as before, were managers of managers, but now a few of the people who reported to him were in charge of smaller teams with specialized areas. For example, Scott's direct reports now included the editor of a quarterly newsletter on industry trends. This individual was not a high-level executive like Scott's other reports, but that was okay with Scott. I'm trying to send a signal that rank doesn't matter to me, he said. Scott also made it his declared mission to liberate information. Originally, the teams here were set up to be somewhat competitive with each other and not share information and resources, he said. My predecessor really focused on individual accountabilities and, to a degree, curated a culture of fear that resulted in excessive internal competition. In trying to mitigate that culture, Scott created numerous dotted line relationships and internal working groups so that everyone knew what everyone else was doing. He also pushed employees to interact with one another. He created cross-functional teams and held skip-level meetings. "I brought together people who would never have worked side by side on their own," he said. "By forcing proximity, I got them to see ways they should be working together, and in many cases, people were doing fun things." All these behaviors were textbook forms of servant leadership, and servant aptly describes how he saw himself. "A leader needs to do what it takes to support his people," Scott told me. Not surprisingly, many people loved Scott and loved working for him. So it was a shock when the CEO pulled me aside as we were heading into a conference room and said, "I'd like you to look specifically at Scott, because we're about to fire him." Strung out, wrung out. The comment was such a stunner that I had trouble concentrating during the meeting. Afterward, I followed up with the CEO and dug deeper into Scott's story to try to understand what was going on. HR showed me that despite the glowing comments from a few of Scott's outspoken direct reports, engagement scores among his employees were generally quite low and trending lower. Worse, people who worked under Scott were leaving the company for competitors at an alarmingly high rate. Scott's peers were grumbling about him, too. A few times, he had inadvertently become a bottleneck, such as when a potential project for a huge retail group in India fizzled because people couldn't get to him quickly enough. And then there was the initiative that he jumped into when the leader had to go out on extended sick leave. 6 months later, he was still project managing it while waiting for her return. When I looked closer, I could see that physically, Scott was wrung out. His eyes were puffy. He seemed distracted. Although he was engaged and energetic, his energy had a frenetic quality to it. The CEO suspected that his faith in Scott had been misplaced. "Why is Scott failing?" he asked me. I didn't have an immediate answer, but my gut reaction was to be skeptical of the implication that Scott was at fault. Too often in situations like this, companies blame the individual when the real culprit is a breakdown in collaboration strategy. As managers rise in big organizations, they are unprepared for the intense collaborative demands they face and are rarely taught how to manage these collaborations from a network standpoint. Part of the reason for the lack of clarity in Scott's case was an absence of meaningful data. The company's engagement scores and departure numbers were detailed, but they reflected symptoms, not cause. So we took a look at the information flow and the decision-making interactions within one of three big units Scott managed. As part of our time-to-market research, we were already partnering with HR to survey the top 10,000 leaders in the company and then zoom in on the 1,800 people in one of Scott's groups, asking managers and employees questions like, "Who do you turn to for information to get work done?" and "Who do you turn to for decision approvals?" We were able to use that data to find out how many people came to Scott for information and how often, and whether they were able to get what they needed from him. Obscene numbers. Our analysis showed that within just this unit, an average of 118 people came to Scott daily for information. Their requests ranged from big questions involving multi-million dollar expenses to minor issues involving hiring for low-level positions or small capital expenditure approvals. This number may not seem to mean much on the surface, but to my eye, it was obscene. That's the only word for it. For context, in an ideal situation, Scott should have had no more than 50 people coming to him every day for information across all three of the units he ran. If our numbers held across the three units, he had seven times that number coming to him every day. We also asked the always revealing question, "Who do you need greater contact with in order to be successful?" We found that 78 people, more than 50% of the 118 people frequently coming to Scott in that one unit, felt they couldn't hit their business goals unless they got more of Scott's time. This was another obscene number. When we see that figure edge up past 25% of a leader's immediate network, we know we've got trouble.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?